Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by SuperValu Insurance, looking out for you and yours with our new life and mortgage protection insurance.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
In his autobiography, Peace Comes Dropping Slow, My Life in the Troubles, Dennis Bradley recalls his years in the service of others as a street priest, a clandestine peacemaker, and a friend to addicts in his adopted city of Derry. He describes what he has witnessed, the violence inflicted on himself and those around him, but also the sense of fulfilment he has felt, the satisfaction that comes from making a difference to the lives of others. And Dennis Bradley joins me now from BBC Radio Foyle. Good morning to you, Dennis.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining me. Listen, it's a beautiful read. Talk to me first about growing up in Buncrana in Donegal.
Well, Buncrana is one of those places in the world that is attached to two geographic places. We're Donegal, but we're also very Derry, in the sense that we're about a few miles from Derry City, and we are part of that world of the Troubles and the history of Ireland, North and South. But we're also very attached or detached from it, in the sense that we were always outside it. We were the other side of the border, and we lived along a shoreline, and we lived in Inishowen, that beautiful peninsula. Mm-hmm. So we were in and we were out. And in some ways, I think that was probably what attracted me to coming to Derry. And I went there, I went to school in Derry. I was a boarder in St. Columb's College, and then went off to Italy, and then I came back, and I had the fortune of actually being appointed to a parish within the city of Derry, and I lived there and worked there and grew up, I suppose, with the Troubles as they grew. I was part of that whole atmosphere and that whole development that was happening from the 70s onwards.
You write really fondly, Dennis, about your father. He looked out for people, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a lovely man. He was a bus driver. He drove the Lochswilly buses between Donegal and Derry, between Buncrana and Derry. And he told stories about growing up in a small place called the Big Hill, which has become kind of famous for, there's only four houses, but there's a number of famous developments from that. There's a large company here in Northern Ireland called the Big Hill. But he was the kind of the poorer side of the Big Hill. And he grew up around the time of the poaching, of the formation of the state, really. And there was great poverty. And he told stories about going out into the bog, being sent out, being asked to go out into the bog, because when he was about 16, 17, 18 years of age, he was well appointed physically, and he was asked by women to go out and find their husbands and take them home because they were sitting at stills making poaching. And he talked about, I have a very strong memory of him talking about the kind of the drops coming out of poaching coming into a cup and men drinking it, who had lost complete hope and life and everything. And he was very affected by that. He never became a teetotaler or a pioneer, but he was a very moderate drinker. I describe in the book that he wasn't a pub man. And later on in my life, when I got involved with people who had drink problems, particularly, and sometimes with drug problems, people used to say to me, oh, did you have experience? And I did have experience, but it was the moderation experience I had of my father, and I suppose a bit of the gentleness of my father.
Why did you decide to become a priest?
It's a big long question. Time ago, Miriam. It's a long time ago, but I was very attracted to it, and I loved the rituals of the church, but I more especially loved the involvement within the community, that sense of community that went to a place that was capable of expressing not just physicality, but also spirituality. And I became an altar boy like a lot of people. I enjoyed that. And then I think I didn't have any great thunderclaps coming into my life, but I kind of examined other professions that I could possibly have chosen. And they didn't really attract me the same. So it was kind of a matter of, would you become an accountant? No. Lawyer? No. Policeman? No. So it was kind of by default in some ways, while also being attracted to that life. And I do think the kind of the social justice, the involvement, the community were aspects of that attracted me greatly.
And of course, when you were in Rome, Dennis, training, you read a lot about theology and you mentioned social justice there. So how did your thinking develop at that time?
Well, I was more attracted, I think, to social justice than I was to theology. I think I might have been, I did all right in Rome. I was no great scholar. I was no great academic, but I was kind of the middle range stuff. But I was attracted to that social justice material. A lot of it was coming from America at the time. A lot of books were being written. I was conscious of people like Father McDwyer here up in Donegal, Glencolum Kill, the type of stuff that he was trying to do within the parish around emigration and so forth. But I was particularly attracted to people like Chavez in Mexico or California, Mexico, people like the Berrigan brothers who were involved in the Vietnamese War, the protest about the Vietnamese War. All of that stuff stirred me. And when I was leaving Rome in 1970, coming back to the north, coming back to Ireland, I kind of was expecting that some of that material, some of that thinking would have been central to the debates that were happening here in Northern Ireland. And I was surprised and a bit disappointed that they weren't really. There was certainly stuff around Martin Luther King, but some of the other people who attracted me, I think, were less known. And I thought that was kind of disappointing, because I think that they had something to offer to a growing political dynamic that was very dangerous, that was turning away from the civil rights movement and growing into a violent struggle in which I describe as the Anglo-Irish struggle that was never really settled.
So when you did return to Derry after Rome in 1970, Derry was of course a city in ferment. How did it feel to be there then? What was it like?
Well, a number of things, Marianne. I was quite young. I was in my early 20s. I didn't come from a highly skilled political family. I don't think I was reading deeply around politics, so I was both shy and uninformed, really. But I was in the cathedral for a short period of time with a very experienced priest. I mentioned, for example, Eddie Daly, who went on to become bishop, Tony Mulvey, who did very good things with people like John Hume and setting up the credit union movement and so forth. I learned so much from those people, and then I was put into the Long Tower Parish, where there was perhaps less interest in that material, but I still possessed it. And then I began to, I suppose, it's not that I had any clarity of what I wanted to do, but I was running into the troubles. I was running into the violence. I was running into the lack of political structures that were then happening, because things were falling apart. The Stormont government had fallen apart and so forth, and there was very little political representation on the ground. So I was beginning to learn as I went along, and I don't know why, but I stayed with it, I suppose. And then I began to form my own opinions, and then I began to say things, and I became more confident on the media. But it was all happening. You had a choice to either go away from that and stay away from it, or get involved. And in the book, I describe sometimes almost like two types of priests. There was those who engaged and wanted to be engaged and felt the importance of being engaged. And there were those who thought that really wasn't the job of the church, or wasn't the role of the church. That was the role of politicians. Although I do also say in the book that most of the clergy and most of the priests at that time that I knew, even those who were uncomfortable with the politics and not being around it, were also very good pastorally. They were very good with the people. They never deserted the people at that time. And I think all of them deserve great credit for that. But there was the divisions, and clerics in those days could be very scathing with each other, because they had had very clever language, and they had great put-downs, which were often very funny in describing their fellow clergy. But they also were very devastating in that they brought a negativity into all of that. It was also very hierarchical in the sense that the curate really had no place, and the parish priest, he was the one who spoke in any issues to do with policy. But he never spoke because that really was the job of the bishop. And very few bishops spoke because that really was the job of the Pope.
In the book, you recall the first shots, the deepening violence. You write, Dennis, we were being introduced to the paradox that conflict and danger can be invigorating and even life-enhancing. Explain that to me.
Well, Derry was, you know, was high unemployment. It was described as the maiden city because most of the women were employed, but very few of the men. And I mean, Phil Coulter's song about walking the dogs, the men who walked the dogs. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of dog walking at the time. It was a city without purpose. It didn't get the university, but it should have got the university. There was all of that, a kind of a neglected place and neglected people. And in many ways, the Troubles reversed that because the whole community became part of something. The media were there. They were interested. They were talking to people. They were going around houses asking where people were. Clergy were being asked all the time to do interviews. In the midst of this terrible, negative, growing destruction of violence, there was also this, I suppose, adrenaline. A communal adrenaline that we were seeing ourselves on television during the night, and we're hearing ourselves on programs by people like Miriam O'Callaghan, who were interviewing people, and all that type of paradox, which kind of invigorates you at one hand and terrifies you on the other.
You witnessed, Dennis, the massacre on Bloody Sunday. You attended some of the dying. You must often think about what you saw then, and just thinking, how did that experience change you?
Well, it changed me in the sense that I wondered, and I had a very good friend called Tom O'Gara who died very young. He was also a priest, and both of us used to do a lot of talking to each other. And we didn't really know what to do. How do you respond to violence? How do you respond to something which you think is highly political and you're just in the midst of it, but you have no real power, you have no real authority to do anything? So how do you respond to it? And we would discuss things like pacifism. I mean, was there a place for pacifism? How would you engage in all of this? Bloody Sunday in some ways defined this, that we had moved about away from the civil rights movement. We had moved away from that this was some kind of local skirmish that was happening in Northern Ireland. And we were obviously into a war-like situation between the Anglo aspect of Ireland and the Irish aspect, the part of the Irish aspect of Ireland, which was republicanism. So we were growing into that. And then the politics kicked into that. How did you handle that? And I was very convinced from very early on that the two killing machines that were manifesting themselves in the daily life of a parish like the Long Tower, the two manifestations of that were the British government in its various manifestations. The army were on the streets. I had seen them kill people on Bloody Sunday, but the IRA were on the streets, and I'd seen them kill people on a weekly basis. So how were you to do that? And my and other people's view of that, assessment of that, was that these two killing machines had to talk to each other and bring the violence to the end, an end so that politics could manifest and grow and become the resolution, or find the resolutions to all of that. Not everybody agreed with that, because the climate of the time was they mustn't talk to each other. That would have been probably the main thrust of the two governments. The British government certainly were saying, we won't talk to the IRA. And the Irish government were very uncertain. So it was very often about the middle grounds need to come together and push out and get rid of these extreme people, either on the Republican side or on the Loyalist side. And I really didn't, I and other people. And the person who brought it about, it certainly wasn't me, but initiated that, was strangely, was an RUC man who was the head of the police here in Derry, a man called Frank Lagan, who said that these two these two sides need to talk to each other, and we need an intermediary, or we need a back channel for that to make that happen. So he introduced myself, Brendan Duddy, Noel Gallagher to the MI6 at the time, and then that game MI5. And by 1975, we had managed to set up a series of negotiations between the IRA and the British government, which lasted for 6 months, but failed at the end of the 6 months, came apart.
It's a fascinating heart in your memoir, though, Dennis, this back channel. So there was Frank Lagan, you mentioned there, obviously Noel Gallagher and Brendan Duddy. Tell me a little bit about all three of you and how you managed to keep the back channel secret for almost three decades.
There are not too many organisations in Ireland can keep things secret for three decades, and certainly that would have been true here in Derry. But it happened because we had to keep it. You couldn't. There were tons of back channels, but most of them either didn't want to stay secret or were blown open and by the media, or people found out. I think there was a couple of reasons. Remember, the media left Derry after, say, 73 or 74, and there was no real hotel in Derry at that time. There was one outside the city, but not in the city. So the media kind of went to Belfast rather than Derry. So it was a bit easier. Secondly, we kept it in the early days. During the negotiations, there was a kind of a group of people from the Republican Sinn Féin sent up to Stormont every so often to be a decoy while the actual negotiations and the meetings took place here in Derry. And the third thing is we learned to keep our mouth shut. And that was utterly necessary, because people don't trust people who talk to or out of turn or out of place. And both of these organisations, the British government and the IRA, were very, very reluctant to get involved in anything that became public before it was due to become public.
In terms of that back channel, how key was Martin McGuinness and the importance of your friendship, Dennis, with him?
He was important, first of all, in the sense that he was very anti the first series of negotiations. He knew of them, but wasn't particularly keen on them. He, like others, thought that first ceasefire, which lasted 6 months, was only there to weaken the IRA and to take away their ability to actually confront the British. There was some evidence for that. Merlin Rees claimed that in his own autobiography. I don't know if it's fully true, because there's other evidence coming out that might be more subtle than that. But whatever about that, Martin would have been against that at the time. And yet, he and I had kind of cooperated on a lot of things. We came from the same area of Donegal, a place called the Illies outside Buncrana. His aunts and were my sister's best friends and so forth. So we kind of knew each other long before it happened, and we liked each other, and we got on, and we trusted each other. And he went sometimes stretched beyond the safe areas for when I asked him to do things, and sometimes I did things perhaps when he asked me to do them that I thought were worthy of being done. So there was a kind of trusting relationship there, although there was an ethical question around that, which I also tried to deal with in the book. But whatever about that, I had left the back channel for about 9 years on the grounds that I didn't think anything really was happening, even though Duddy and Gallagher kept it going. I thought the British were prolonging the whole thing and not really engaging at the level that they should have been engaging. But McGuinness came to me one time around the end of the 90s and said to me that he thought they Republican movement had to become the peacemakers. And we had a long conversation around that. And I said, he and Brendan Duddy didn't always get on that well. There was a kind of personality clashes around that. And I said, look, to make it easier for you, I'll go back into the back channel, because I think what you're talking about is vital. And if there's an opportunity for that to happen, then let's try to make it happen. So I went back into the back channel, and McGuinness became totally committed to that whole thing over a period of time. And I think at one or two occasions, I think that he really pushed the Army Council or the IRA to places that they were perhaps uncomfortable with, but he did it with great aplomb.
No, it's a hugely interesting part of your memoir, Dennis, and so important actually to the eventual peace we got. I need to ask you about Mary, your wife, where you met her and when you realised you were in love with her and that you had to leave the priesthood, and how tricky and difficult was that for you?
Well, first of all, I met Mary because she came to me to tell me that she was thinking of going to join the volunteers overseas, which was kind of which was African based, and people went and lived in Africa for a period of time. And I managed to persuade her that there was a lot of work to be done in dairy, and that she should think it. She was a teacher. I said, why don't you do some stuff around? I had already set up a hostel for men who were kind of skid row alcoholics, they were called in those days, who were on the streets. And it was a dangerous time to be living on the streets. So I had already set up with other people. And I asked Mary to do some research around, not just about that, but mainly about the addiction thing, because I was meeting a lot of women, and again, I talk about this in the book, in the confessional, who were living with men who were drinking badly. And I began to understand the awfulness of that, because it was worse than, say, physical illness, because it was quite often kept under wraps, and it was quite often ill-defined in the sense that people didn't really know what was happening, except that he was getting drunk every often and sometimes beating his wife up. So I asked May, would she do some research instead of going to Africa, would she work on that? And she left teaching and she explored all of that. And Mary's an incredibly good researcher, and she's a very intelligent woman, and she was far way ahead of me and all that type of stuff. So she kind of led that movement to set up Northland Centre, and I got involved as a therapist in that, and she was an incredible therapist. But anyway, we got married. It wasn't easy. Those were the days when clerics, when they fell in love with somebody and left the priesthood, they either left their parish or they left their neighbourhood or they left the country and went and worked somewhere else. And I didn't want to do that, and Mary didn't want to do that. So we kind of settled into being here, and we continue to go to the church locally. And I think that, I mean, some people tell me nowadays that they admired that and they thought that that was the proper and the right thing to do. And it wasn't easy because clergy weren't comfortable with it. Other people weren't comfortable with it. And yet I think the laity, the broad, the people in the Longtower parish were incredibly good to me and very, very, very warm. And by the way, there was also some clerics who were incredibly protective of me. And we went off to Connemara and got married quietly. A friend of mine down in Connemara married us. And Tom O'Gara, who was my best friend, who was a young priest, who died not that long after that, he was kind of our witness. But we didn't have our community around us to celebrate our marriage. But we got through it, and my mother, you know, I talk about in the book that my mother found it difficult, family found it difficult, but my mother came to really, really like Mary and was dying about my children.
It's very romantic, though, you know, heading to Connemara. Yeah, I just listening to it and think, this is very romantic. It's true love.
It's true love. Yeah, but we are truly in love, so it's lovely.
Like it wasn't easy. Do you still retain your faith?
I do. I talk a little bit about that in the book too. Sometimes people used to say to me, why didn't you become a politician? And I try to explain that the biggest effect, I think, in me, that in my personality and my belief system were trying to hold on to, I mean, I have a strong definition that faith is this kind of 50-50 mixture of faith, believing in something and yet being totally doubtful about it. And there's no need to be worried about the doubt that comes into you, because that is part of what faith is about. So I believe in politics, but I don't want to be a politician because I think that it's not deep enough. I think faith brings you to a different place. And I think the people who affected me most and brought me there were, again, probably the women who came to me in confession. They formed me more than anything outside of my own family, I think, because of their openness in the confessional. Mm-hmm. And I do talk in the book about the fact that it's been a shame that we have lost the sacrament of reconciliation, because it was a therapeutic place long before. And I mean, it was badly handled. I know we were in a black box and people had to kneel down. But the actual ability to come and reveal and open yourself to somebody else is incredibly important, and as we are now all saying around the whole mental health issue. And I think I learned all of that in the confessional box. And then went on and became a therapist within the Northland Centre. And I loved that. I loved the freedom of being open and speaking your mind and talking about yourself and not being afraid of your own feelings, the negative feelings as well as the positive feelings, and the necessity to do that. So I loved all of that. And I think that brought me to places that politics seldom bring people to, in the sense that politics is really about the out external structure. It can't deal with the internal structure, and it's the internal life that I suppose that ultimately satisfies me more than the external one.
Well, it's a fascinating read, Dennis. Your memoir, Peace Comes Dropping Slowly, by you, Dennis Bradley. It's a great read. It's published by Merriam Press. Thanks for taking the time this morning to speak to me, Dennis.
Pleasure. Thank you.